Great.
There you go.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. It's great to see you all on screen, enjoying whatever weather you're enjoying. I think, Nenzen, you guys are getting some storm up there in the central part of California in the mountains, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Yep, it's back. Raining steadily, but beautiful.
Yeah, well, wish you well. I think the Sierras are really going to get quite a bit of snow. So stay dry and stay safe up there. Yeah. I wanted to start out before we dive into the book chapters of this week by thanking again Mado and Michael for leading our discussion last week. Really, really appreciated your thoughtfulness and overview of those chapters and the thinking that you got all of us inspired to do relative to those chapters. So bowing in gratitude to you, and thank you so much. And Mariko, can you get us launched for this evening, please?
Sure. So this evening we're covering two chapters, actually. And Bill Powell and Tetsuho Chris, they're going to be leading the overview and discussion for Chapter 6, Deepening One's Perspective on the World. Followed by that, we'll have Juliana Fabio and Ekudo-san, who will address the content in Chapter 7, The Path of Liberation. Following each presentation, we'll invite the entire Sangha to comment and ask questions. But to be able to fit it all in, at some point, we might have to nudge to move on to the second group so we don't go over time too much. So Bill and Tetsuo-san, feel free to begin when you'd like. And I'll share my screen now if you'd like, Bill.
So,
Bill, I think you're on mute. Can you unmute yourself, Bill? Here, let me see if I can do it for you. Hold on.
Hey, Bill, I think they changed the Zoom app around and the mute might be on the bottom now of your screen.
Bottom left.
Yeah.
I also sent you a little thing that says ask to unmute it, so it might be popping up as well. Fish. There you go.
Great. Bill, would you like me to share your notes now?
No, I'm not starting.
Okay.
I'm going to start and then use half our time, and then Bill's going to come in afterwards. Okay, so I'm going to give an introduction to the chapter, sum it up, and when I'm done, Bill is going to come in and he's going to give a deeper perspective, possibly what's beneath the story that Buddha tells. So the chapter, Deepening One's Perspective on the World. In this chapter, Buddha's addressing primarily monastics, and he's telling them in no uncertain terms that the world is a dangerous place, that there is nothing in and of this world of sensual pleasures and seductive forms, no handhold, no mooring, no safe harbor that will protect them from basically suffering, misery, and death. And he doesn't hold back. There is war. There are beheadings, suppurating sores, dangerous burning charcoal pits, betrayals by ones you love, body parts, and awful diseases. He's like an overprotective parent scaring the hell out of his children. Only instead of telling them to stay put, hunker down, and hold on, he's telling them to let go. In the story of King Kauravaya and the venerable Radhapala, a very powerful king visits a young man in the king's pleasure garden. Radhapala is a young man in the prime of life. I don't know, he's got everything. Think of him as like a young Brad Pitt or young Gwyneth Paltrow or something. He's beautiful, dark-haired, he's healthy, he's wealthy, he's got a load of friends and admirers. He's got everything, but he's chosen homelessness. The king is confused. The king says, there are four kinds of loss: through aging, through sickness, loss of wealth, and loss of relatives. I can understand you being here if you've experienced those, but you haven't. You've got it all. You are a black-haired beauty. You're strong and fit, glowing with health, rich, and everyone, and I mean everybody, loves you. What are you doing under this tree with nothing to your name but a ratty robe and a bowl? And Radhapala responds, great king, I have understood these four summaries of the Dhamma. One, the world is unstable, swept away. And basically that means impermanent. He asks the king, he points out to the king, you were, as a young man, you were a great archer, a wonderful swordsman, a charioteer, strong. What now? And the king agrees. He says, man, I was amazing when I was young. And now it's quite a bit different. And Radhapala says, the second summary of the Dhamma, it has no shelter, no protector. And basically at any minute, anything can happen to you. I mean, to us, a plane can fall out of the air. You can get hit by a car. There's COVID. There's just basically no way to protect yourself. The third summary of the Dhamma, it has nothing of its own. And that's pretty obvious to us. Basically, you can't take it with you. No matter how rich the king is, when he dies, it's gone. He basically doesn't own anything and have anything. He's just borrowing it. And finally, the summary of the Dhamma is it's incomplete, insatiate. Basically, it seems like we always want more. The example is given, the king has a rich kingdom, and he's quite well off. However, he admits, if he hears of a adjacent kingdom that has stuff he wants, is rich, doing well, he's going to conquer it. So Radhapala tells the king, I've understood these things, and I choose homelessness because in reality, what else is there? What else do I have? So not only living in the world is a massive bummer, but it's short too. Life is fleeting. How fleeting? Well, Buddha says years ago, people lived for 60,000 years. And that wasn't near enough for them. It was like 60,000 years. Geez, I hope I make 65,000. Nowadays, a human lives only to maybe 80 years. We're like fruit flies. Poof, and we're gone. But life is fleeting. Not only that, but there are people who think they are happy. Buddha says, silly fools, they're like a leper scratching or cauterizing his sores. It feels good in the moment, but he's going to end up with infection or worse. Momentary happiness, ultimately greater suffering. I mean, we've all had mosquito bites, for example, or chigger bites. I one time had hundreds of chigger bites, and there was no greater bliss for me than scratching those chigger bites. It was exquisite. By the end of the day, I mean, my skin was burning, I was bleeding, there were sores. It ultimately, the bliss was very fleeting. I thought I was enjoying myself, but I was really creating suffering for myself. Buddha goes on, not only that, But the people you see having a good time, enjoying the sensual life, you know, like the envy of all of us poor schmucks, hey, it's like they're a dog gnawing a bone. It tastes good, but there's no nourishment. Buddha said, well, Buddha doesn't say they're pretty chill, but he basically says that. But he says, take away their bone, take away their piece of delicious meat, this bit of meat that all the other dogs and all the other people want. Take away their dreams, their beautiful possessions, and they'll definitely freak out. I mean, you must see people, a lot of you are from Santa Barbara, so you must see a lot of people who seem very equanimous. And they seem like they're having a wonderful time and nothing can bother them. But Buddha talks about their equanimity being diversified based on diversity. Their equanimity is dependent. He suggests it's better to have equanimity that is unified, based on unity, not dependent on a particular thing or situation. And that's basically what Buddha's selling in this situation, basically free floating equanimity. So Buddha's painted a picture of a pretty grim place. And he goes on and on, gives many, many examples of how pretty much horrible many things are, many situations are. Remember, he's talking to monastics. And he says, on the surface, this place can be pretty seductive, beguiling, delightful. But if you peel back the pretty picture, you are definitely in the hell realm of samsara. To ask what to do. And he answers, you better appraise your objects of attachment. Take a good look at those pleasures you enjoy, the forms you appreciate, the feelings that feel so good. See what is really there. How? Well, there's a process he talks about. And the process consists of gratification, danger, and escape. So he says, observe the gratification, the danger, the escape. They are related. In fact, he finds it so important to recognize this process and understand it that he did not feel he was truly awakened, truly enlightened, until he had looked deeply into this and understood it. We do things because on some level, they temporarily satisfy us. We receive gratification. Feels good. According to Buddha, without gratification, there would be no danger. And without danger, there would be no escape from the world. And basically what he's saying, no escape, no enlightenment, no awakening. So thank you, gratification. You are the key to awakening. So Buddha talks about the process being we recognize gratification in any particular situation that, you know, that's easy. It feels good. Then we look into it deeply. We see its impermanence, its resultant suffering. We see it being subject to change. We understand that we cannot count on it or cannot count on its satisfaction lasting. It's like a good friend you think you have. She's all chummy and charming, except when you need something, when you need her help, then it's like, sorry, and she's gone. Gratification ultimately is fleeting, and that's the danger. We look at sensual pleasures this way. And you know, sensual pleasures are not just eating, drinking, sex. Sensual pleasures are massage, they're sleep, they're nice clothes, they're a nice home. They're heat, they're cooling when it's hot. Ultimately, Buddha shows us the dangers, how sensual pleasures devolve into feelings of, I don't have enough, I want more, or I have so much, I have to protect it, or my neighbor wants it, I have to fight him in order to keep it. It's cold out, I want to be warmer. It's hot out, I want to be colder, or people steal from me, or I steal from people, or I'm in prison because I did stupid shit, and on and on. So Buddha pretty much paints this picture quite clearly, what is resultant from gratification. Basically, gratification is transitory, and that's its danger. So we see this, we see the gratification, we look into it deeply, we see the danger. We see this in sensual pleasures and forms. So there's sensual pleasures. He also talks about forms. An example of a pleasing form is a beautiful woman or man. However, he goes on and talks about eventually that beautiful woman or man is just a bunch of body parts and guts and bones strewn about charnel grounds. Doesn't last, transitory. We understand gratification. We understand its danger. What now? Now escape. And how to escape from this danger? Easy. Just abandon desire and lust. Buddha says it over and over and over again in the chapter, and that's about all he says about it. Just abandon desire and lust. So this is where Bill comes in, because we are about to go deeper, and Bill's going to take us there. Thank you.
So thank you. That was great. I've read it many times, and that put it pretty succinctly. So, having appraised
Is this too soon?
Oh, I see. That's me. I wondered. I thought something went wrong. No, that's me. All right. That's good. Okay. Maybe I hope it's big enough for everybody to see. That's where we're going.
Just tell me when to scroll.
Excuse me?
Just tell me when I should scroll down.
Oh, okay. Yeah, got it. Thank you. So, having examined basically what Chris was talking about was life in the or existence in the realm of desire, kama, the kama dhatu, and the cycle of gratification, danger, and escape in the realm of desire, which is basically where we humans hang out with a collection of motley crew of other group of beings and demons. So what interested me, one of the places that interested me most in this chapter, is where he goes to look at the jhanas. And this is the text that's up there now, is the jhana where he introduces this idea. This is the Buddha talking to a bunch of monks and distinguishing the Buddhist path from that of other ascetics and wanderers. So he says, what monks is the gratification in the case of feelings? Feelings, I didn't think that was going to get into meditation, but that's where it is. It starts with feelings there. Here, monk, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters the first jhana. So he's already gotten beyond what Chris was talking about. He's abandoned a lot of the afflictive issues that were affecting the realm of desire. And he's sitting in meditation, or he sits in meditation. And the monk, and when that happens in seclusion, in retreat, the monk enters the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. Thought and examination, beginning practice of meditation, thinking his way in, achieves a state of rapture and happiness that results from taking the path of meditation. On that occasion, he feels only feeling that is free from affliction. These were the afflictions that Chris was talking about. And again, with the stilling of thought and examination, enters and dwells in the second jhana. So he's lost now the first part that he started with, thought and examination, and now rapture as well. With the fading away of rapture, he enters upon and dwells in the third jhana. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, he enters upon and dwells in the fourth jhana. The highest gratification is freedom from affliction. And what monks is the danger in the case of feelings? Same as the Kamaloka, impermanent, suffering, subject to change. Damn, and I thought I was doing all this meditation and it was just going to stay that way when I got some kind of rapturous experience. But one soon learns that they're not permanent. Keep coming back and maybe it gets better. A lot of times it doesn't. I think the real acid test is a retreat. 1 week, one month retreat starts out and one's literally in hell for a while after the first rapture, and then it kind of goes away. And when one begins to go down to these lower levels, these other levels, deeper. And again, like the Kamaloka, escape in the case of feelings is the abandonment of desire for feelings. Now it's no longer the desire for sensuous pleasure. And that's been separated from through his practice. So this is a pretty stern warning to recluses and monks. The assumption that things are going to get better once you meditate enough. And as a note of interest, the term jhana is the Pali form of Sanskrit, the Sanskrit dhyana. Sounds the same, it's just different initial. When it's translated into Chinese, it still sounds the same because it's jhana, channa. Dropping the final N, which happens in China and is carried to Japan, it becomes chan. And read in Japanese, Zen. That's right, Zen Buddhism. Right back to where we are. And one of the things that I wonder about is thinking about these various descents, lower and lower, and eventually ending up only with the highest gratification of freedom from affliction. How much have I felt some of those feelings going through early stages and later stages of meditation, even in the first few years of meditating? So the question that occurred to me, and that I hadn't expected to happen in the Pali text, is how similar is this to experiences that you and most of us have when we take up meditation, not only Zen meditation, many forms of meditation. Something to chew on. So the four jhanas are all represented as states of mind. They're also represented as destinations. But in, not yet.
Okay.
That's okay. It doesn't matter. I'm not reading this one anymore. So they're states of mind that transcend and are free of sensual pleasures addressed in the beginning of this chapter. The attachment to sensual pleasure is, in fact, the defining characteristic of the world of desire. So we're in a different world now. We've left the world of desire. It's where we humans hang out and endure a long time. With other beings such as hungry ghosts, hell beings, angry devas, devas, and animals. Most of the time, but not all of the time. So no surprise then that it's the lowest world in the Buddhist triple world cosmology. The triple world cosmology starts with the world of desire and moves next to the form world, the world of form, senses of form. And this is where the meditations take place. In fact, the meditations are one of the primary accesses to this second level. And it's clearly some form of monasticism or seclusion. But as we find out later, not necessarily. It can happen anywhere. It can happen at any level. So the middle world, the world of form, is exclusively jhana-based and is made accessible through the wholesome behavior in the world of desire. That's basically kama, karma, kama in Pali. Kama and rebirth. States of mind are where kama and rebirth occur. So Bhikkhu Bodhi introduces the fourth chapter, one before fifth chapter, the ones before this, with the following comment about karma and desire, rebirth. It's in the introduction. The twin doctrines of karma and rebirth enable us to see the world in which we live in important respects as an external reflection of the internal cosmos of our mind. An external reflection of the eternal cosmos of our mind. This does not mean that the external world can be reached reduced to mental projection in the way proposed by certain types of philosophical idealism. However, taken in conjunction with these two doctrines, they do show that the conditions under which we live closely conform to the mind. The reason why why a living being is born into a particular realm is because of previous life that being has karma, generated karma or through volitional action that leads to rebirth in that realm. Thus, in the final analysis, this is the important line: all realms of existence have been formed, fashioned, and sustained by the mental activity of living beings. And I think that's what is Bishop Bodhi, I'm going to call him. Maybe he's become an Episcopalian. Bhikshu Bodhi arranges these three chapters, the one we're coming to and the one we just finished before this one, which is where that introduction appeared. Note well that the mental states of the jhanas as part of the triple world are all impermanent, filled with suffering and subject to change, and hence not the ultimate goal of Buddhist practice. And this, to a large extent, is what distinguishes Buddhist practice from that of many other traditions. All of this realm, as well as the third world and the triple world, the third space, all exist within the cycle of samsara and therefore are subject to impermanence and suffering. The danger is one gets trapped in one of the levels and fails to proceed or develop further to investigate, and ends up, if you go to the end of the chapter, you go to the four Brahma lokas, what's the first one? Sympathetic joy is the third one. What's the first one in the lokas?
Loving kindness.
Loving kindness, right. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and finally, equanimity. In the end of chapter four, each one of these is compared to mental states of activity that we've seen through the four stages of the Kama Loka. Each one of them exists in the realm of form and can be correlated with a mental state. And what he does is he says, Buddha teaches that the person, there are four, he says four kinds of people, but really he's talking about two most of the time, fill their mind, all four quarters of their mind, with loving kindness. And they exist this way for a long time, and then they enter a realm in their own experience of bliss that resulted from going through the four Brahma lokas. But they live for that, they have a time limit. And the kind of shocking thing is, after some of the ascetics have lived that long, when the time limit comes up, they fall into the deepest hell. They just don't drop down a step or two, they go all the way to the hell. And some and the lower levels, the prethas and so on. But the monk who continues to develop and not attach to the gratification of the four Brahma lokas ends up at the doorstep of cutting off all conditioning factors and ready to enter the state of arhatship, maybe ultimately nirvana. Now, I'll end with that, but there's one other little point that came up that interested me. The texts say that all beings through all time have existed at one time or another in every one of the 31 realms of this samsaric world, which means everyone has existed for a moment, at least, if not more, in a hell realm. So the seed of enlightenment is there, and they trace that through, and they say even a hell being, because he has the roots, he has a seed in even having been in hell, has the potential to become an arhat. And I think my time is up. So let's take some questions. If not, let's go on.
Taishin-san?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and get us started with perhaps a little bit of discussion. Thank you, Tetsuho and Bill, for a wonderful presentation. Perhaps a question of clarification. From the reading, it sounded at times like gratification itself was a problem. And that didn't feel quite right to me. It felt like attachment or clinging to gratification was the thing that's really at issue. And it sounded like this is how you were understanding the distinction in section 8, whether an uninstructed worldling or a noble disciple goes up or down, for lack of a better way of putting it. Is that correct? That if you're attached to the pleasant meditative states or the cultivation of the Brahmaviharas, you'll fall down into a hell realm, but if you're not attached or not clinging, then you'll go elsewhere when your clock runs out? I don't remember the language well, but I think you get the gist of my question.
Yeah, thanks for that. I think there's a lot of ambiguity in the language in the Pali Sutras. Maybe it's in the translations. But is it that the gratification or the desire for gratification that matters? In fact, that's how I actually phrased it, I think, in one of the readings. I dropped out the abandonment of pleasure and kept the second statement that the Buddha delivered, which was the desire to abandon the desire. No, what is it? What was that? How did they put that? It's the desire that's the problem for gratification or for sensuous delight. So actually, Tyson, that's occurred to me for the last 20 years. I'm always bothered by that little kink in there. Is it simply an abandonment of everything, of all those things? Is that the problem, or is it the moment-to-moment desire for various things? Yeah, thank you. What's my answer? I'm going to go with your idea in mind. I'm there. I've never been happy with the total abandonment. Doesn't seem to ring true, actually. Although in many ascetic traditions, it does. In fact, wasn't that what the Buddha abandoned when he left the ascetics? So, no, that's not the middle way.
Anton-san?
Thank you so much, Bill and Chris. I have a question that is connected to some of the karma descriptions that you had when you were sharing the screen. And it was described as a volitional action. How would you compare volitional action and designer? What similarities and what differences do you see in those two?
What are the two again? Say the two.
Volitional action as an act of will and desire. Both of them have directionality, right? Like you choose where you make the volition.
Yeah, volition is... Yeah, go ahead.
Is it that the desire is grasping and volition is directing the light in a way?
Karma is not determinative. It inflects and it creates a tendency, is the way I read the text. Tendencies. And therefore, the volition then becomes the central issue. Based on volition, one responds to the tendencies that are present to them. So if you can build up a load of unwholesome karma, rather than bad karma or black and white karma, unwholesome karma that leads to descent, or you can build it up on the other, and that creates an agree. It's a volitional decision. The Buddha defines there are four essentials for volitional action, including the existence of an object of the action. I forget what the four are exactly. And he's very specific about what constitutes a volition as opposed to simply a desire. I think that's the basis of your question, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he actually creates a set of four qualities. It's like a legal case. You check off each one of these things. You do this, that's volition. And that gets you there to the problem with karma. But karma is not accidental. The Jain tradition in India, for example, takes a different view of karma. Karma is everything that happens to you, intentional or not, as a result of what you do. Even when you're not conscious that you're doing something that's unwholesome, will come back to get you. Buddha said, no, if you are not aware and did not volitionally choose to do this, it's not so much the awareness, it's the volition, then the karma is non-effect. There's no karma. It's mental. It's mentally rooted speech and body behavior that constitutes volition. Mentally rooted in mind, thought, amounts to speech or action. And if it's mentally intended, then that's one of the necessities of karma, a karmic connection. Now, it is, obviously is not a rule book like you would have in a monastery. These are tendencies. So yeah, that's the question. Actually, you asked exactly the right question. What's the difference between desiring something and volitionally? You may desire it, but choose not to follow it. And that creates positive karma. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. I think in the interest of time, we should probably be moving on to our next practice partner pair in the next chapter, chapter 7. Thank you so much, Bill and Tetsuo. If we could turn the microphone over now to Juliana and Ekudo-san.
Thank you. Would it be okay to share our screen? We have a PowerPoint.
Let me make sure I can allow you to do that. Yeah, it says multiple participants.
Okay. And it's been really wonderful working with Judy. She's so knowledgeable, and it's been some wonderful conversations. And so we put this together, and it was rough the last time we did so. Judy, please feel free to add or take away anything. I'm going to just put it up real quick here and introduce it. Okay. Can everybody see that okay?
Yes.
Okay. So our chapter is chapter 7, The Path to Liberation. And we had some discussion points, which we may or may not get to all of them. Why does one enter the path? The Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path, Sangha, good friendship, the graduated training, abandoning the five hindrances, jhanas, and then we had a little bit at the end for some thoughts and questions. So I'll turn it over to Judy.
So Yeah, I just want to give kind of a quick overview of these different, the five different parts of this chapter. The first one, so first of all, in the introduction, it says, we're now coming to the unique distinguishing feature of the Buddha's teaching, its supramundane or world transcending path to liberation. So now this path to liberation leads to what they call nibbana, as, or we know it as nirvana. And I'd like to just give a definition of nirvana, which is, quote unquote, blown out as a candle, as in a candle. Okay, and this refers to the stillness of mind after the fires of desire, aversion, and delusion have been extinguished. Okay, that's nirvana or nibbana. This chapter focuses on clarifying the purpose of the path. So in the first section, we talk about why does one enter the path? So there's a story by Malun Kyaputa, who basically asks a question of the Buddha. So he meets with the Buddha, and he has these questions, and he says, well, you know, depending on what, how the Buddha answers this question, I'm, you know, if he doesn't answer it to my liking, I'm going to leave. Okay. So he basically asks about, he wants to know, because he's not heard the Buddha talk about this before. So he's going to, so this guy asks, so the world is eternal and the world is not eternal. Or is the world finite and is the world infinite? Okay. And then he says, is the soul the same as the body? And is the soul one thing and the body another? And then after death, a Tathagata exists. And after death, a Tathagata does not exist. And then after death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist. And after death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. Okay, so basically we're talking about eternalism or annihilism in a few of these comparisons. So eternalism would refer to the soul and body being different, or the Tathagata existing after death, okay? And annihilationism is the soul and body are the same. Meaning, let's say if the soul and body were the same and you were to die, that means that's it, you're done. There's nothing else. Annihilationism, right? Or if the Tathagata does not exist after death, then that's it. That's nihilism again, okay? So there's a combined view though here where the Tathagata both exists and does not exist, okay? He exists and he does not exist. That's the combined view. Or there's the agnosticism or the agnostic view, which is the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. Anyway, this is kind of confusing to me, but basically based on the footnotes that I read, from the Buddhist perspective, the Tathagata exists as a self. Just kind of an interesting thing, because in Buddhism we say there is no self, right? So that's kind of a question maybe we can talk about later. So the interesting thing, the interesting part about this story is that this fellow Malankhyapata, he ends up, so basically after he asks these questions, the Buddha actually doesn't even answer those questions. He just talks about something else. He just says, you know, it's that this is where he introduces the Four Noble Truths. So he doesn't even answer the questions. He just says, there is suffering. There is the origin of suffering. There's the cessation of suffering. And there's the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So he introduces the Four Noble Truths here. Now, there's in this first section, there's three sections. The second section is about heartwood, or essential purpose of spiritual life. So there's this story about, they talk about the, reading my notes. He talks about the, there's this story about the elephant hunter. And we're not really going to go into it, because really the second part is just that the basic thing about the second part of this chapter is that heartwood equals the essential purpose of spiritual life. Okay. Then the third part is the fading away of lust. Now, the definition of this is the dispassioning of passion, or the delusting of lust. Okay, so this is where, you know, this really ties in very well with the previous chapter, that, you know, that Bill and Chris talked about, regarding, you know, letting go of things. Now, the second part of the chapter talks about the analysis of the Eightfold Path. Now, they use the word right here, and that's a typical right, but it doesn't mean right versus wrong. It, in some texts, they call it, instead of right, they call it perfect. But I like to think of it as wholesome view, wholesome intention, wholesome speech, wholesome action, wholesome livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So when the Buddha talks about the Four Noble Truths, in the fourth noble truth, he talks about the path to liberation. Now, this is attained by living by the Noble Eightfold Path. So he talks about the right view as being the knowledge of suffering, the knowledge of the origination of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So the right view is basically having in mind the Four Noble Truths. Right intention refers to the intention of renunciation, non-ill will, and harmlessness. Right speech refers to abstinence from false speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter or gossip. Right action is abstinence from the destruction of life, taking what is not given, and sexual misconduct. Right livelihood is having abandoned a wrong mode of livelihood and earning a living by a right livelihood. Right effort generates a desire for the non-arising of unarisen evil and unwholesome states. Right effort also refers to making an effort around arousing energy and applying your mind and striving. It also refers to generating a desire for the arising of unarisen wholesome states. It generates a desire for the continuation of arisen wholesome states, for their non-decline, for their increase, expansion, and fulfillment by development. And the Buddha made, and the right effort is by making an effort, arousing energy, and applying your mind and striving. I know that's a bit, that's a long one. Sorry. Right mindfulness is dwells in contemplating the body in the body, which is ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed longing and dejection in regard to the world, right? Non-attachment. It's just being mindful of the body in the body. Right mindfulness also is dwells in contemplating feelings in feelings, the mind in mind, and phenomena in phenomena. And right concentration dwells in the first jhana, which is thought and examination. So now we're bringing in right concentration. The way the Buddha puts this is he talks about the four jhanas in right concentration. So the first jhana is thought and examination, secluded from sensual pleasures. Okay. And then when you're subsiding of thought and examination, you enter and dwell in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind. And it's without thought and examination, and has rapture and happiness born of concentration. Now, with fading rapture, up comes equanimity, and you're mindful and happy, which is the third jhana. And then the fourth jhana, when you're abandoning pleasure and pain, you have purification of mindfulness by equanimity, the fourth jhana. So that's the Eightfold Path. Next, in the next section, the third section, it talks about good friendship. And basically, all this talks about is what this means is Sangha. And as Koban put it, Sangha is actually the most important jewel, right? Because we're talking about community. We're talking about living in a way where everyone is working together. Not everyone has the same mind, but at least there's respect and there's a working togetherness of Sangha. In the fourth section, the Buddha talks about the graduated training. Oh, this is where he talks about the elephant hunter. I'm sorry. This is where he talks about the elephant hunter. And here he talks about abandoning the five hindrances. So the five hindrances are abandoning, well, here are the five hindrances: sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and the fifth hindrance is doubt. And then in the fifth section, the last section, the Buddha talks about the higher stages of training with similes or the four jhanas. So basically, I just want to say that at the end of this chapter, interesting part is at the end of this chapter, where he says, when his mind is thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilements, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he understands this is suffering. And then he says, birth is destroyed, the spiritual life, and in another part, he says it's the holy life. So we kind of have a question about that. Birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what has to be done has been done, there is not more coming back to any state of being. And so that's really the end of the chapter. Yeah, basically talking about liberation. So, Jules, did you want to talk about some of the questions that you had?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Judy. That was a wonderful summary of the chapter. And for me, you know, I'm still figuring this all out, and I've reread this chapter so many times. It was really helpful to talk with Judy about it. And then, yeah, for me, what really rang true, first of all, was the part on good friendship and Sangha, and how, you know, there it says the entire spiritual life is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. Sorry, I can't speak. But that just, it just the creating community, which we always talk about, just so important. And it was nice to read it in here. Another piece that was really interesting for me was on this one, talking about liberation on page 237. He talked about being diligent. He obtains perpetual emancipation, and it is impossible for the monk to fall away from that perpetual liberation. I love the word perpetual. I like the idea of we're always seeking, we're always curious, we're never better than, we're never worse than, we're always humble to being curious and being open and seeking. And I think that piece right there really spoke to me, and the word perpetual. But as Judy said, you know, near the end there, there were those lines about, you know, birth is destroyed, the spiritual life has been lived, or the holy life. What has been done, there is not more coming back to any state of being. And so I think for me, the biggest question in this is, you know, there are so many stories that build upon themselves. Many of the monks discussed eventually reaching liberation. Is there a finite point at which liberation is reached? You know, I understand Buddhism to have no finite beginning nor ending. And again, that's why I like that word perpetual. And yet in some of these stories, there does seem to be an end point on the path to liberation. So it just seemed like that was probably, at least for me, the biggest question of the chapter. And that's pretty much what I had for that. I don't know if you wanted to add anything else, Judy.
No,
Any other questions?
We're open to questions or discussion. So a question, is spiritual life and holy life different or the same? Because we think of spiritual life as being something inside of us, like in our mind or that kind of thing. And then, you know, is it really holy? I don't know. I think it's a good question.
Emmy has a question.
Can
you come closer?
Yeah.
And then we'll hear you better.
Yeah, hi, and thank you so much, everyone, for the talk and this latest chapter 7. So I don't have an answer to the question, but it seems to me this is the first time I've heard the Buddha talk about spiritual life. As the name spiritual life, so I don't know if that's just me, but I was curious if he does refer to it at other times, and then I haven't noticed. But anyway, that's just my comment. Thanks.
Thanks, Sammy. Any response to that?
Mado, have you ever heard of the Buddha talking about spiritual life at all? In your many years of experience?
With my vast knowledge.
Yes.
I'm observing noble silence. I mean, I really don't know what he's ever talked about spiritual. I know I've heard the word holy a lot.
Yeah.
But spiritual, I'm not sure, but that's a more modern way of talking about this path that we're on. So holy seems to be the word that I would most associate with Buddha, with the Buddha Dharma. Yeah.
Thank you, Mado.
I should say this, that I loved your term de-lusting. spiritual,
yes.
You know, spring cleaning, the emotional spring cleaning, de-lusting.
Yeah.
But I, you know, in connection with your question about spiritual, I think that there's a kind of de-lusting or de-something of holiness to make it spiritual. Mm-hmm. I think there's a de-something or other that's going on with the holy life that makes it spiritual, in much the same way that de-lusting makes us something non-lusting. So there's something seems very modern about spirituality.
Yeah. Agreed. So what I actually think is happening here is, you know, when the Buddha is talking to these monks and he talks about the noble truths and then he explains about the Eightfold Path, I think he's really laying out the way people need to live, you know, in order to to ease suffering. Because really, I mean, that's there, because he says in the third noble truth, there is the cessation of suffering. And the way to get to it is by the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path. So I think if we put into practice the Eightfold Path, and if we live by the Eightfold Path, I think it, in our life today, it could greatly reduce our suffering. I mean, I know it does for me. So. Are y'all living by the Eightfold Path?
Just a thought, you know, I'm thinking about the Eightfold Path, and I try and I fail. But it really, for me, it seems to be undergirded by compassion. And that makes me think of kind of the golden rule, right? Everybody's familiar with the golden rule, and that seems to be kind of a universal that we find in all different beliefs, worldviews, religious systems. Treat others as you would like to be treated, some iteration of that. But I was having a conversation today, and the gist of it was, a woman I know, a chaplain, was talking about, she was asked by a physician, there was a body lying on a table, and then next to the body was a heart. The heart had been removed from the body. And the chaplain was asked by a doctor, "So, chaplain, tell me, where's the spirit here?" And she thought, that's a great question. And she answered as a chaplain would answer, "What does your faith tell you where the spirit resides in the body? Or, you know, where's the spirit reside?" But we were talking about locality and even the idea of liberation and the notion in Mahayana Buddhism where you have the bodhisattva that does not go on and leave, leave this cycle of birth, death, rebirth, but instead stays and helps others ascend, realizing that we're all in this together. There's no really separation between self and other. And anyhow, we were talking about this and the localization of the consciousness, the idea that the soul or the body, the person is inhabited by a specific little finite point in space and time. And it reminded me of a dissertation. I was doing my qualifying exams, and we were talking about Western notions of out-of-body travel, spirit leaving the body, stories of such. And a professor stopped me and he said, "Well, you know, that's a very Western concept, this soul leaving the body." He said, "In certain yogic traditions, this experience is not a soul leaving the body, but it's the soul becoming aware that it goes far beyond the body into the whole of the all." And it just really, I'm rambling at this point, I'll try to be succinct, but it really ties in. For me, I see these, the Eightfold Path really is being at its core, compassion, understanding that there is no separation. There is no finite self. It's all interconnection. And I'm going to stop there. Thank you for listening to me rant.
Thank you for that, Michael. Did you have something, David?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a question and would love thoughts from others on the text describing good friendship in Sangha. Because I think this was Buddha's answer to Ananda was written at a time when they belonged to a monastic group, and they were all monks. They were kind of all trying to follow the same path, and we're not. We have jobs, we have family, we have in-laws, we have awkward Thanksgiving dinners, and so it made me wonder about the modern application of this idea of good companionship, good friendship, good comradeship, because Buddha says it's everything. to the life. And so my question was, what does that entail? Is it your relationship with your teacher? Is it your relationship with other people like us on a book group together where we're really very interested in common ideas? Is it our relationship with everyone that we encounter? And I was really trying to understand that relative also to people in my life who are not on the same path. They kind of encourage me to let's go look at the new Tesla. Let's go see if we could add a hot tub to your backyard. There's a little bit of encouragement towards craving and materialism in some of the folks that I hang with. And so I was puzzled by this idea of how do we think about Sangha and good companionship on the path? So I'll stop there. If anyone has thoughts, I'd love to hear them.
Is the question, will Buddha go look at the new Tesla?
Chodo-san, I love this question, and thank you for bringing this discussion back. This is Bodhi, by the way. She comes with the room here.
Hi, Bodhi.
Thank you for bringing the discussion right down to the ground of our practice and existence, because it's a great question, and definitely look at the new Tesla and get the hot tub. I'm teasing you, but I think that your question is really profound, and it's about relationship all the time. So if you zoom out, Sangha zoomed out, it actually does have to do with your decision about the hot tub and the Tesla. You know, this kind of big view about these intimate relationships suggesting you look there, they're not bad. And your looking is not bad. It's about context, context, context all the time. And that means relationship. All of the various relationships that you might encounter in everything. So, you know, I think Koban actually did say this thing about, you know, everything is Sangha. And I think that's a really beneficial thing to walk through the world, not seeing these things as good as bad or right or wrong, but wholesome reaction and wholesome engagement. And I see you, Taishan, but I want to make one more point, because my internet connection is very weak. And I don't know if I'll be able to stay. And that is, I found that very profound. He doesn't call it the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, but I hope those of you who are at Nehane saw the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, because he talked about the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. The body is a body, thoughts as thoughts, feelings as feelings, and reality is reality, phenomenal reality. And I found this is really an important thing for those of us in this non-monastic, none of us are monastics, even if you're living in a monastery, you're not a monastic way they were monastics. And I think it's very important to be able to kind of make harmony with the Buddha's teachings about non-clinging. Thank you, Taishan, for that distinction. I suffer with this one too. I just wanted the Buddha to say the lentils were so good tonight, just once. You know, that he would experience pleasure. We could say, yeah, the lentils were great, and now we're letting them go. So we could talk about attachment and clinging a little differently. But what I really want to say is, yeah, the body is just the body. The feelings are just feelings. Thoughts are just thoughts. And my experience is, this is my body. These are my thoughts. These are my feelings. This is reality. Both and that's our life. Both and. So I think it's really important to remember where we are and how we are going to live our lives, not separating. That's all I want to say. I hope you could hear me. It's
Aishan.
Yeah, I thought I would. just sprinkle a little something on top of Nenzen's offering. She mentioned Koban having something to say about Sangha being everything. And a student once asked Koban what Sangha is, and Koban replied, a bottomless garbage can, which in this context means it has room for everything.
Thank you, Tyson.
Sangha will spill in the garbage can today.
Can I just add one thing?
Sure.
Dave, I think it's a good opportunity to ask Dave if you could see a hot tub over there or a Tesla in your driveway or something.
I'm going to be open to the idea. I'm going to look at it, realizing it's certainly something that catches your attention. You know, whether you get hooked by it. Is another issue. Yeah.
Are you saying a hot tub could not be beneficial action? Is it necessarily a hook? Is it Tesla a hook?
Oh yeah.
I'm not sure. Not necessarily.
It ain't necessarily so, as the song goes.
I think it's the craving of it that is the issue. Yeah.
Me too.
Can you see it? Can you see it for what it is? Or does it become something that's so substantial in your desires that it takes you out of the middle way of living, out of balance?
Yeah, my comment about the lentils was really about this. We are supposed to enjoy our lives, right, folks? You know, without doing harm in a wholesome way, doing good, stopping evil for the benefit of all beings, but enjoy the lentils. And that's what's right in the bowl in front of you. Slurp them up. Enjoy the lentils. I don't know if the Buddha ate lentils. I don't know why I'm getting lentils. I must be hungry. But the point is, enjoy your life. And it's a hard decision sometimes to make what is going to be skillful enjoyment of your life, what's not going to cause harm, because basically everything we do, just breathing and digesting, causes some harm. But there you go. You know, I think that the problem with these readings and the analysis of these readings is that it starts to sound like, you know, life is hard and then you die. And that's not his message. Not ultimately. So.
Tova.
I think the hook for me, or the question for me, in terms of this idea of clinging or hanging on, has to do with that right effort. So what I've found in my life is the need to develop the passion to stay on task, or to stay, or to have a passion, to find the interest and therefore go for it and really put the effort in. That requires some clinging. It requires some kind of hanging on to it. Some, you know, I see people who have kind of this bulldog ability. They grab it and they just chew it to bits. And then they come up with something profound because they put all their energy there. And so when I look back and I think, where has it been that I've found that tenacity? I think that's right livelihood and right effort. And how do we do that without clinging?
Bill?
Yeah, I made a list of all the synonyms that go with exactly what you're asking. Remind me of the old song, "You Can't Get to Heaven in a Cadillac Car." There's an, it keeps going, the song, and you can't get to heaven in a rocking chair. The whole point is you can't get to heaven with any of these things. And the point of having a Cadillac or a rocking chair ain't to get to heaven. It's to be in the right place. And so here are the synonyms. Thirst. Doesn't necessarily mean clinging. Thirst. Craving. Infatuation. Delight in. Attachment. Some of those work pretty well. And those come out a lot in the Buddha's talks. So a thirst is a compulsive drive. Effort, right effort, is part of the paramitas. So when you talk about effort, it may not mean clinging. It's more like something else, like the persistence you talk about. So yeah. The whole point of even that you can't get to heaven through the third jhana, and even the fourth jhana, it gets you in the right place to start to get there, but it's not going to get you there. It's not the cause. So you have to do something else. So anyone who thinks that you get there just by meditating all the time, they're missing. These are the people who drop back into the hells, according to actually chapter 6. Can't do it. So it's non-causal. It makes your life more difficult if you have to go down a few ladders in the line, but hopefully you stay on the path. I stay on the path. That's a good one. I'm with that. But yes, good question.
Thank you, Bill. And by the way, I'm coveting your Tesla.
You can't get to heaven in a Tesla. Or in a hot tub.
I want a Rivian, though.
When does it stop?
Yeah. Actually, that was the other thing I wanted to say. In your chapter, Tetsuho and Bill, there was this line that I laughed out loud. Sometimes I mean to put my foot here, and I put my foot somewhere else. I love this line. This is the guy talking to Master Ratapala. Says, sometimes I mean to put my foot here and I put my foot somewhere else. And I thought this was a really slightly like kind of this weird little offshoot for me about karma, that, you know, cutting off a karmic thread, stopping a karmic thread, which, by the way, Juliana, that's the way I look at birth and death. You're stopping a karmic thread. You're not repeating this cycle of samsara with respect to one little thing. Let's say just one thread that you've teased out of your habit energy. But I thought it was really funny. Sometimes I mean to put my foot here and I put my foot somewhere else. I think it says a lot about how we actually work with our own tendencies to repeat unskillful conduct, and that nirvana is stopping that. Nibbana, stopping that. Putting your foot where you intend to put it, on the path that Bill just talked about.
Thank you, everybody. There's nothing else. Is it time for the three refuges?
Or a poem.
Do you have a poem for us, Nansa? Okay.
Please someone tell me if you're tired of these poems. I'm kind of still in love with them, so they keep coming. These are from the first Buddhist nuns. This one is Uttara. Her name means crossed over. I asked Patachara, what is the path? Patachara said, just see all thoughts, words, and actions arising all by themselves not from some imaginary point within. I only partly understood, but I took a seat. As the sun was setting, I saw the endless line of one thing leading to another that had brought me to the cushion that night. As the moon was coming up, I saw the arising and passing away of all things in every direction. As dawn was breaking, wisdom rose in the east and set fire to the long dark night. But don't take my word for it. Set fire to the darkness within. I promise, it's like nothing you've ever seen.
Thank you, Nenzen, so much for sharing that with us. And just one more thing before we close with the refuges, and that is I wanted to thank Bill, Tetsuho, Juliana, and Ekudo for leading tonight's conversation. Really wonderful presentation, so thoughtful and inspiring. So grateful to you for those conversations. And remind everyone that next week, we will be looking at Chapter 8, Mastering the Mind. So get to reading, and we're looking forward to connecting with you and talking about that next week. And Mariko, I turn it back over to you.
So now it's time for the three-bit refuges. Sorry about that. Jumped the gun a little bit. Ekudo-san, would you share your lovely voice with us again?
Sure.
Thank you.
Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutyampi buddham saranam gacchami, dutyampi dhammam saranam gacchami, dutyampi sangham saranam gacchami, tatyampi buddham saranam gacchami, tatyampi dhammam saranam gacchami, tutyampi sangham saranam gacchami.
Good night, everyone. Thank you very, very much. And see you next
time. Was there a power outage? I lost contact for 20 minutes.
I'm in Santa Barbara, and I didn't experience that, Bill.
Okay. Sorry. My end.
Yeah. See you all.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
All right. There we go.